Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 92 of the Free Cities Podcast. I hope you are well. I have to be quick today, I'm afraid. I'm flying out to Ulaanbaatar in a few days, and I have a list as long as my arm of things to do, so I'm going to be brief. Today's guest is Ukrainian journalist and PR expert Tanya Rack. Now, Tanya works within the Liberty Movement, spreading ideas of freedom at places like Fox News, CNN, and BBC, to name a few. And as you would expect, this conversation revolves around all things media, or what I might call the science of communicating. Media literacy, AI's impact on journalism, fake news, social media, fact-checking, media bias. Does any of that ring any bells? Well, if it does, listen on. For Tanya's takes and more, she also reveals her experiences of the gender divide at work, and whether or not that is something that needs to be addressed. You can check the show notes for all the links you could ever need to know about Free Cities and the different projects currently happening all over the world. And if you're the kind of person who needs to experience it all IRL, that's in real life for all the old folk like me, don't forget that our yearly conference, Liberty in Our Lifetime, is just a matter of months away now. You can get your tickets online at libertyinourlifetime.org, and I will see you in Prague, and you can thank me later. Or, of course, you could, in our time-honored tradition, just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Tanya Rack. Life topics.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with life topics then, because that's what I actually like. What do you mean by life topics?
Just generally views, you know, this type of stuff.
Okay, then. What are your core views then? Let's get straight into it. I know you're I would call you a journalist, is that right? But these days, people wear a lot of hats, don't they?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Well, yeah, I think that I can identify myself as a journalist, if we can say so. But also I do communications. I'm working with Peer Innovation, which is a network of think tanks. I also do some political analysis. I do freedom activism. I do editing. I do project management. So yeah, you are quite right about wearing many hats.
It sounds like communication. Under an umbrella term, it sounds like you're a communicator and you have a bunch of ideals you want to communicate, I take it.
Yeah.
So what's at the core of that then? What's the core of your... I don't want to call it ideology. I don't like that word. But ideas, let's say.
Yeah, ideology sounds too harsh.
Well, it's got a bad reputation recently, hasn't it? When you say ideology now, you think of brainwashed people spouting an ideology and not thinking about an alternative. But I think everyone I know is always self-reflecting. If you believe in something, you're making sure you're testing that theory always. And therefore, I kind of steer clear of it. I don't know whether you would call yourself an idealist.
So far, not. I think that I can be a bit idealistic in some points, but at the same time, I'm quite a rational person, and I'm trying to speak with the language of facts. The thing is that facts is usually a universal thing. You know, something just happened, and this is a fact. But then, when you are coming to observations or your POV, of course, that will always be subjective. And the more POVs you hear, the more opinions you hear, the more difference you will see. What else I would add is that probably as a journalist and as a person who is working with communications. I'm trying to get as many different opinions and views as possible because I think the truth lies somewhere in between.
That's interesting because I think journalism and facts don't necessarily go together very well these days. If you look at, I come from the world of journalism, and I would say the mainstream world of journalism. I worked for a national newspaper in the UK for 7 years, and these days I would say that trust of these organisations is at an all-time low, I would say. And I was looking on Twitter this morning, someone posted an article albeit it was from a very left-wing publication, and that's fine. I don't mind you being a left-wing of publication if you want to be, but everything that was said was so patently wrong, and yet no one seemed to be acknowledging this at the newspaper. It was Salon. It's not even a newspaper. You know Salon?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Horrendous. Right. And this is many people's experience these days. When you see an article about something that you actually know about, this was an article about Bitcoin and Trump, and it was saying that Trump is now endorsing Bitcoin, which is used for illegal activities. So instantly they decided, right, Trump is bad, therefore we now need to say that Bitcoin
straight
is bad.
Away.
Right, okay. Now, when a publication such as that talks about something you actually know about and it's completely wrong, then from that point onwards, you doubt everything they say. And that seems to be what's happening in the media these days.
It's kind of horse trading, I think. But at the same time, I know that, of course, there is a big impact on human minds. But I also think that there are certain audiences. And if some people start reading the article, you know, like you mentioned about Trump and Bitcoin and illegal activities and black markets, probably when a person opens the magazine and newspaper, online media, whatever we are talking about, this person is already biased. This person already has opinion and opens media just to prove this opinion, which is also good for media because this is how they define the audience. This is how they define topics. But I do not think that there is any, you know, objective information here. I think that, ideally speaking, media should operate with facts, with proper investigation, with proper background check. But I'm also realistic, and I understand that it does not happen always.
How do you, as a media, as a publisher then of facts, how do you reach out to people that are only looking to confirm their own bias? Can you? Is it possible? Or do you just ignore and put your energy somewhere else?
I'm always trying to have a conversation with a person. For me, it is extremely important to understand what a person stands on. And sometimes that's fine. We may not have the same opinion on certain things. But if I understand the background of these thoughts, where they come from, and why a person is like that, and what is the most important is that person is sure about the arguments, then we talk. But if a person just stands strictly on this is black and this is white, then I will go and put my energy in a different direction. However, I think that it is in journalism and media and communications, we all operate with the narratives, and the narratives have been built from something. So I think that if we can change them, we can add some flexibility to the conversation.
Are you comfortable with your own narrative, and your own bias, let's say, do you admit that publicly when you're writing? I mean, in the same way that Salon is unabashedly left-wing and everything it says adheres to a checklist of left-wing ideas. What about yourself when you're writing or communicating? Is there a bias in what you do, and is it something you freely admit?
It really depends on what I'm writing, because if I'm writing the article that requires investigation, facts, and I'm covering just something that happened recently, some event, then yes, I'm trying to be as much unbiased as I am. But at the same time, I think that there is a difference in genres. If you're writing the opinion piece, if you're writing the column, then you can allow yourself to be biased. But then usually, even if you are publishing something with media, there is always a disclaimer that this is the opinion. And the opinion might not go along with the official policy of a particular media.
And you do, so you do opinion pieces?
I do with Speak Freely. I can allow myself to do that on my personal blog, which is natural because people are actually coming for my opinion and they want to know me and what I stand on. But if there is a general coverage of some issue, I'm trying to be as much objective as I can and I'm checking different sources. Some of them might be controversial. Like I will give you an example. Let's say that I'm writing the analysis. I'm writing some freelance political analysis with Polish press agency. Mostly I'm covering the political and economic relations between Poland and Ukraine. And of course, even if you go in depth, especially these days, for example, with farmers' protests or something like that, you can go on Twitter, right, and you will see the Polish POV, which is fine. It has the right to be there. There's also some objectives there. But then you also go to the Ukrainian site and you will find it there. And I cannot write it from the Ukrainian POV simply because I'm trying to find the reasons behind the crash. I'm trying to explain where each side stands on, how it happened, and what and how exactly it could be resolved, if it can be. Just to give you an example, because there are so many topics like that, and that's why it is really, sometimes it's hard, but I think that you should stay cold in that sense.
A couple of things there. First of all, you better explain what Speak Freely is first. You're an editor at Speak Freely, are you, or are you a writer?
Well, I'm an editor, but recently I moved to partnerships.
Okay. So what is Speak Freely?
It is a platform that allows young writers, activists, those who are interested in politics, economics, technology, to submit their materials. Quite often we publish some opinions, but right now we are pivoting this medium and we are planning to expand it to a correspondency program covering different affairs in Europe and hopefully soon beyond as well. It was established by the prior generation of Students for Liberty. As far as I know, the name was created by Bill Wirtz. And now we're taking over. I've been with this project for 3 years. And I think it's lovely because it is complicated to get your first publication. So I remember how I was starting. And I have a profile education. I'm a journalist by degree, one of degrees. And I remember when I was pitching to big media, at that time that were national media, so Ukrainian media, and the first thing that they were asking me, okay, show the portfolio. And I was like 18, 19, and obviously I could not have that big portfolio at the time. So I think that if there is an ability to work with some real media, even if it's not the biggest coverage, it's not, you know, the New York Times or whatever, it's good to start from because then you expand, and also you define the scope of topics that you are mostly interested in, and then you can pitch other media. So I think it's beneficial both for us because we are getting content and we are getting more writers and future and current talented journalists on board. And it's also beneficial for those who want to write and get their voices heard.
You just mentioned the New York Times there. And my relationship to the media has changed drastically over the last few years. Like I say, I come from this world. And I suspect now that getting published in the New York Times is not as important as getting published in certain independent media outlets. And I think the tipping point's happened, for me it has. And I'm thinking about the largest podcasts that you listen to online having way more reach than even the New York Times. And the one, it appears that the biggest podcasts in the world are the ones that have a neutral perspective on things. And I think that's where the places like the New York Times really sort of like fall down is they have a slant, they have a an agenda, and they seem to push it. But what do you think about that idea that publishing in old legacy media news outlets is not as important these days?
Well, I think that it depends on the market that we're working with. Because I think that at least in Eastern Europe, there is still a certain rate. If you can get published with such giants as New York Times, then probably it could be a good thing for you and for your portfolio, and most of the people still crave getting there. However, if you dig deeper, I agree with you that this media, they are going through, I cannot say crisis, but I think that the level of trust initially decreases. As for me, I think that sometimes it's better to go for some niche media. Niche media that are precisely working on the topics. For example, I got a very good coverage with HackerNoon. I do not think that HackerNoon is of the same size. And in fact, it's built in a way of the blog platform. So you just write the piece, you submit the piece, then editors review, and they either do some edits and they publish, or they are actually good. They don't ghost you. They give you a very constructive feedback on what you could improve. And if you improve, there is a good chance that they will publish. But anyway, I think that I got lots of people who have something in common views-wise, or fellow professionals who reached me out after the publications there, than I got from going live. I went live with Fox News a couple of years ago. So yeah, I believe that this is the thing.
Hmm. I mean, I think we live in the age of niche news rising now. And like you said, many of the large news outlets are being watched by people who aren't looking to have their minds changed anyway. And I don't know what your experience on Fox News was, but did you find that there was much feedback afterwards from listeners, viewers, people that saw you or heard you, compared to something like HackerNoon, which I agree. When you go to places which are, I mean, we're the same at Free Cities. We have a small following, but we have a very loyal following. And when we need to reach out to people that are interested in the Free Cities ecosystem, it's very easy because everyone's listening. They're very into it. But I suspect it would be hard to ever have mass appeal. Possibly, I don't know. Who knows what the future might hold? But we're under no illusions that the idea of living freely is going to become that widespread. I think when you look at the world, you see that the majority of people aren't interested in it, actually. And that's fine. Most people are happy to be living under some form of oppressive society. They don't mind it. They'd rather just not deal with it. But there's the hardcore, I don't know, maybe 20% of people who really think about this stuff. And
you know, 20% is actually big.
Yes.
In a sense that I can understand where it comes from. I think that not everyone has a sense of self-control. That's why it is easier to live according to the rules that are already set and you just follow, because it takes off the burden of responsibility, the burden of having these long conversations with yourself at night. Everything is just clear and understandable, and you just, as they say, you go with the flow. I hate this phrase, by the way, but you kind of do. And even recently, I understood that I am bubbled in a sense. It was also connected with some journal work. I was helping out a friend. She has the agency in public affairs. And they are doing some project connected with media freedom in different countries in European Union. And she was asking friends to reach out to locals and to ask them, so guys, what do you think? How is the situation with media freedom in your country? So as I'm based in Poland now, she asked me whether you can ask people around. And I was like, yeah, sure. And I wasn't at home for a couple of weeks, so I'm coming back. And I think, okay, today is the day. And I'm going to the downtown in Warsaw. And I think, okay, there are lots of people, it's weekend, it should be fine. And I started approaching people. I thought that I would finish in an hour. I needed to record around 30 interviews. it was so naive of me, because most of the time when I'm reaching people out, they either ignore me or they say that no recording, please. And that was just leading me to lots of thoughts, because first of all, if people are not ready to get their faces recorded, first of all, it's okay, I respect privacy. But whether there is a real problem with the freedom of speech then, with the freedom of media, then why they do not feel comfortable? Because usually if people do not want to get it public, it goes beyond the privacy issue. It's either that they think, okay, where it will get published, which consequences I might have. So my question was, is everything, you know, that crystal clear in that field in Poland? The second thing is that I would never ever face this problem if I approach someone at the conference like Liberty Now Lifetime or LibertyCon or anything in the bubble. People won't even ask me where it goes. Probably I won't even have to specifically prepare them. You know, even when you're doing networking post-conference, you might share a drink or a coffee, and these topics will flow naturally. But that's exactly the moment when I realized that, yeah, probably I'm living in a bubble. So I was walking around Warsaw for 5 hours. It was really embarrassing. And it was giving me social anxiety. And I'm naturally extroverted. I think I'm actually a yapper. But then I was so careful with approaching people, because I'm like, hi, I'm a journalist. And I was trying different approaches. Hi, I'm doing the poll. Hi, I'm this. Hi, I'm that. Plus, lots of young people, which was also surprising to me, they were not speaking good English. And mind that it was a capital, so I really don't know how the situation in other cities. But in the end of the day, I recorded around 9 interviews. I was super tired, and I got the rest of the interviews when I was at the local conferences. So I just got back to my bubble. And getting back to the thought that we started from is that, yeah, I understand why people feel more comfortable when they're living in a certain sense of control. Because again, it takes off the responsibility. And you just exist in this space that someone already determined for you. And there the rules of the game are very understandable and simple for you. You just know that you are doing A, it leads to B. You are doing C, it leads to D. And if you do not have that sense of control, well, lots of responsibility comes to you. And also you probably will have to think about these rules of the game. Maybe you will have to even set them up, which is also kind of stressful.
You're from Ukraine, right?
Yes.
Am I correct? Yes. And you've reported on the Ukraine war, have you?
Yeah.
Yes, I thought so. What's the biggest misunderstanding coming out of there then? I suspect that it's reported from many distinct angles. And as a Ukrainian, you were in Ukraine when the war started, right? I think you were running Students for Liberty in Ukraine, is that right? Or you were part of Students for Liberty?
A part of Students for Liberty.
Yeah.
To give you the background, I'm coming from eastern part of Ukraine, from Mariupol, which is currently under occupation. But at the beginning of the war, I just recently moved to Kyiv. So I witnessed war in Kyiv, but my family was in Mariupol. And Students for Liberty actually had this program that was activated for specific conditions. And they helped me to get out of Ukraine because it was very hectic. I honestly did not know what to do. I was thinking just about getting back home to my mother. And the reason why I didn't do that is, first of all, because it was very complicated to get tickets. And the second thing was that my friend, who actually fled from the city with me, she told me, yeah, but think about this in that way. You live literally 2 hours near the border. And if something happens, you both will get trapped. If you get trapped, no one will help her. And in fact, she was right, because then the blockade started and they cut all the connection, the data. Actually, everything, because there was no gas, no cold water, no hot running water, nothing. So when I got out of the country, I I think it was very humanish. I did not think specifically as a journalist, but of course it was all connected. I was just very scared for my family that was left there. So I was 30, so I started raising awareness about the hostilities that were happening. And yeah, they were covered from different angles. I also think that it is very necessary to use the right wording. For example, I do not like when people say there is conflict. I mean, conflict is that there is a conflict of interest. When the sovereignty is being broken by another state, it's not the conflict, it is invasion and it is war. And it is very important because I see that a lot in Western media, and I also think that it changes the perspective of people. Because let's say you are a farmer somewhere in the US and you do not resonate with it that much. Of course you feel sorry for people if you're a good human being, but it's not like it's on your daily agenda because you have your life. And frankly speaking, I do not expect anyone to be that much deeply in the context. It is impossible to re-experience that. But I think that if you have a chance to build the communication and to explain what's really happening, then you have a bigger understanding. Because communications, journalism, reporting, it all played and still keeps playing a very crucial role in how Ukraine is getting the international support these days. And it comes with everything. It comes with, first of all, with humanitarian aid, with the armor, with the perception of Ukrainians domestically and abroad in foreign affairs. It all comes together.
So what would you say is the biggest misunderstanding about what's happening within Ukraine at the moment then? You mentioned that people, from your perspective, don't see it as an invasion. What about, is that the main thing when you look at the way that it's reported on?
I think that this is one of the crucial issues, but at the same time, I find, I'm just thinking because there are really many things that I would touch base on. Even with social media, quite often online media use social media channels to attract the attention of the foreign audience. And a couple of days ago, I'm on Instagram and I saw a picture that actually made me feel horrible. There is a picture of a lady who is doing the gender reveal on the grave of her husband, and there is a caption like, "We have a daughter." And it's actually very traumatic to see these images. And it's just one example. It's not the worst one, because when there was the massacre in Bucha, in Irpin, in Mariupol, in lots of other cities, the flood in Kherson, everything, all in all, it's also very devastating emotionally to see. But there is a problem with social media that quite often there is a mark that you need to put. The image was generated with AI, and sometimes it is used just when the caption is being put on or some automatic translation is being put on. But imagine that you are sitting somewhere in the US, I don't know, in Asia, and you decide to check, hey, what's going on in Ukraine? And you're getting on Instagram and you see the image, very traumatic, very devastating, AI. What would you think? You probably would think that this is fake news and we're just using that, you know, for the propaganda. The way how social media operates, sometimes I think that it brings complications. Also because some images are being marked as sensitive content. And then Meta, for example, it takes down the coverage. And from one hand, I understand why it is being marked sensitive. I think that there is even a whole ethical dilemma about, for example, whether you can put any images of corpses on social media from the perspective of respect for their families, for example. At the same time, it is very important to see that these are just not numbers, but that were real people and they suffered. So from that perspective, it is important. Another thing is that some people are not that much aware of what's happening. I actually remember in winter, I was in New York and I'm just getting morning coffee And it was a very busy coffee shop, so there were no places. And some woman approaches me and she's like, do I have a seat? I'm like, yeah, sure. And she hears my accent. So she asks me, where are you from? And I'm saying, I'm from Ukraine. Oh, from which part? Oh, you know, Eastern Ukraine. Is there still war? So you see that there is the problem with coverage reports and press. It's not that Ukraine is the only country on the daily agenda. There is Israel and Palestine, or Israel and Hamas, whatever we call it. The protests in Georgia, always a threat near Taiwan, etc. So it is important for the country to stay on the global agenda, to communicate properly, and also for journalists to work in synchronization.
That issue you mentioned about images being labeled as AI on Instagram, is that an automatic feature of Instagram? And if so, how does it know, how does it decide that something is AI generated?
Well, actually, I think it's more a question to the DevOps, but I think that it is a recently integrated feature, because I saw that as a mark on the page that I run for my think tank. I do not have this feature on my personal account, and I could not find it in the settings. But this is a feature that I have it. So I assume that they actually might test that on some parts of accounts, and I'm not sure whether it is just that widely accepted. Or alternatively, and this is a theory, I did not prove it, so don't take it for granted, but you can actually choose the type of the account that you run if you do the public account. So maybe that applies for these type of profiles that identify themselves as nonprofits or creators or media, and then that might be an option, because for my profile it's just a private profile.
But your experience of those AI tags were that they were wrong. Is that what you? That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
I wonder how it's working it out then. I mean, and also with regards to what you said about showing images of corpses, I was a photojournalist for 8 years in London, travelled around the world, went to a few wars myself, and this was always an issue for us, thinking about photographing people in their worst moments, basically. And I never felt comfortable in that situation, and I never would, and it was always something that we all talked about. There were some people that had no problem with it at all, and they believed that the news is the news, it needs to be shown. And then there was the other side of the spectrum who just felt bad for people, right? What I find interesting now, though, with Instagram is Instagram is populated by non-journalists, and this changes the dynamic somewhat. You can take, like, if you're a father in Ukraine and your daughter is injured, you can choose whether to show that picture or not, and you have some sense of ownership over this. This is your family. You can ask them, can we, you know? And I think it then becomes a lot fairer in a situation like that to show people in their worst times, because you are choosing not a journalist who doesn't know you, who's just seen what's going on, but someone who's actually connected to these people, who can actually talk to them, who can find out, look, do you mind this picture being revealed? And but then of course you have the flip side of that is, at least when I was a journalist, there was honor amongst journalists to report the news correctly and to report it as best you could. These days, with everyone being a journalist, I don't know how much of it is real, how much of it is made up, how much... It's very difficult to tell these days. Where do you go for your journalism? How do you decipher? I mean, the fact that Instagram is creating now an AI tag shows you that in another 10 years... The world of journalism is going to be an absolute minefield of what is real and what is AI. So where do you currently look for good journalism, and where do you think it's going? How do you prove yourself? How do you get to the place where people trust you as a journalist?
So first of all, I think it's a good point regarding photojournalism. I don't do photojournalism. So usually I'm requesting media for using their images. If I had to, I would ask the permission. And I also do not think that if someone decides to post the picture of their family member, that automatically means that they got the permission. Unfortunately, these are the cases. And even if we get back to non-war times, it's quite a popular thing when parents are posting pictures of their kids on Instagram, which also creates lots of issues with privacy. And I really do not think that this platform should be to the kids under a certain conscious age. But getting back to the point, I think that AI actually brings lots of challenges, but at the same time, opportunities. Because it is a new tool, and right now it is not on the advanced level because everyone is experimenting, everyone is playing with the AI. But as much as it grows, I think that there is always the response for that. So if there is the AI, there will be AI detectors. If there is AI-generated visual content, there will be tools that will allow you to detect that. If there is the article that is written by ChatGPT, it will get more advanced because these tools are learning based on the data. But I do not think that journalism is in a threat because of that, because I know that there is lots of debate regarding whether all writers, copywriters, journalists, communications people will be replaced by the AI. No, I don't think that they will be replaced, but they will manage that. Because we need to take that as the as a good assistant, but you are in charge of that. And how to look for trustworthy sources, how to prove yourself. Again, verify many, many more times. Try to find different resources and do not just click the first link on Google that you will find or on TikTok. I know that there is a trend of TikToking information, not Googling information, especially among Gen Z and Gen Alpha. But statistically speaking, I read somewhere that most of the internet users, they do not go lower than the third link on the search bar, which is quite wrong. And I was actually carrying on the experiment. I was doing some lecture on media literacy fact-checking for students and asked them to read the article and to find me sources. And most of them, so they opened the article and it was a very good article in a sense that all the backlinks, they were included. So if you want to, and you want to dig on the stats, let's say that 5% of population that they did this, there is a link where they found the research and then control F and you can find this information. Only 2 people out of 30 did that. Otherwise, no, they did not even ask a question how to check it, what to check it. And I think that it actually creates a bigger problem for older generation, like my mother generation or grandparents generation, because internet still was not a thing in their youth. And now they're a bit like babies, so they go on Facebook, they scroll, and they do not care whether it is AI generated and what the source. They will just share, repost, retweet, and they take it for granted. So I think that it is just important to speak and to educate people about how you can check the information, how you prove the resources. Maybe you should go to some official website if you are searching for the stats. Let's say that you are covering some registration, then go to the website of the respective country and check what the thing with this just read. It won't take you that much time. Just analyze the information and then put it aside, go for a walk, drink some coffee, better matcha, then get back and go for this information, do something with it. So, and also I do not think that you need to be afraid of the technology. You need to embrace technology. Technology drives human progress. It drives human creativity. You just need to understand how to work with it and how to manage it, what threats are coming and how to overcome it, as with everything, I guess, in life.
Something, you mentioned AI detectors there in in information and journalism. And I agree that the whole industry of tools are being produced and will be produced. What I find uncomfortable about the notion of AI detectors, though, is it's very easy to use them nefariously, to use them in a bad way. Say, and we see this a lot now in pre-AI days, if somebody wants to discredit something, all they do is sow a seed of doubt about that thing, and instantly you lose half the people who might believe it. If you have an article, and governments do this very well, something will be reported on that's not too, that doesn't show them in a good light. And if they then produce some feedback which undermines the authenticity of the information, even if it's wrong, even if it's a lie from the government, people, once they feel that sense of doubt, you'll lose a lot of people. They'll say, oh, it's probably not true. And you can do that with AI detectors very well. As you saw on Instagram now, there are things being labeled as AI which aren't AI. And that, you can never recover from that. You know, once, it's like being accused of something serious. It's very hard to recover back to the position you were in before the accusation. And I see that as one of it'll be a tool for disinformation in the future. I don't know what you think about that.
I definitely think that it is a challenge for disinformation, misinformation, controversial statements, everything that is arising. But it's not like it's not arising these days, because we already live in a world that is very fast-paced, and we get lots of info messages. And how they say, at least according to the open sources, that human brain cannot really process more than 100 info messages. And then imagine that you wake up, you check your emails, and then it's doom scrolling time. You go on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, and these messages, they just flow. And probably you won't have that much time to analyze this information. Plus, the amount of information generates clip thinking. Clip thinking is when you cannot really focus on something for longer than, let's say, 5-10 seconds. And that is especially addictive in terms of TikTok and Reels, because they produce very short content, and then it is harder for you to concentrate on something longer. And of course, with AI, yeah, you see the statement, you probably won't analyze that. You say, aha, fake. If you think, of course, about fakes, maybe you won't care at all. Fake, okay. And then you scroll, 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 and then you will definitely have this opinion. But again, that just makes clear the social request to speak more about how to detect that, how to prevent that, what are the counter instruments, and what is still the way how you can work with AI. I think that we do not need to wear pink glasses that AI won't be trained by, let's say, special services, by governments, to promote the certain information and the narratives that are convenient to them. Because, yeah, these machines, they learn based on the data that you put on. So if you label something as black and some other thing as white, they will get trained and they will deliver the other statements in that way. Then, okay, then there is a social request for fact-checking of this information, and we do not need to make it something niche. Because right now, of course, if you go to some tech conference or a communication conference, journalism conference, then, of course, these topics, they will be highly discussed. But if you just go, you know, to the fields, somewhere to the office, probably people won't care that much. So probably one of the tasks of those who are working with communications, with public opinions, is to make this topic more easy, to make it easier to deliver to broader audiences. And it should not be a rocket science, like there is this one tool. No, just say, okay, verify, fact check, and you can do it X, Y, Z, very simple.
I don't know whether this is actually fake news or not, but I saw something on social media the other day, and it was a short video that a lady had made comparing her two different Facebook feeds of the same story. And what it showed was, once again, like, I haven't fact checked it. I looked at it and I thought, that sounds about right. But she had two phones. One was her phone, one was her boyfriend's phone. And I forget the article. It was a pretty dividing article, something about refugees or something. I don't know. Or maybe it was something political. And because she leaned in a certain direction, when you read the comments afterwards, you saw people backing up the left-wing side of the story. And on her boyfriend's phone, because he was a little bit more right-wing, it was a completely different set of comments, basically backing up the right-wing stance on the same thing. And that makes very much sense to me, that that is actually happening, because comments are being curated by the networks. They're trying to show you something that might be of interest to you, but also that keeps you there or makes you comment. And it's one of the big problems with having journalism in a place like a social network, because the network is incentivized to do whatever it can to keep you there. And with news, that's always to show you something that makes you angry or something that, you know, and they know very well, and I don't know whether this is your experience, but people read the comments more than they read the articles. I would guess that that's across the board very common. I do that myself. When I see an article, on social media, my first thought is, I wonder what everyone thinks about this, because I'm looking for a few ideas about what the general sense of opinion might be on this. But as this video showed, that's the worst thing you can do, because the social network is showing you a biased version of the comments, and it's tailor-made to you specifically. So, I mean, is that something you've experienced yourself?
Not that much, honestly speaking. I monitor comments from time to time, but I prefer to read just the source, and then I will just type in the case that I was reading about, and I will read that from many, many more other sources, and then I know how my attention span will go. I will probably think, okay, but what was the reason behind that? And I will spend countless hours with just Googling what really happened. But sometimes, of course, I'm curious what people are thinking about that. But again, I know myself, I will probably go on Facebook. I will read around 10 comments and then I think, okay, curious. Then I will go on Twitter. I will type in the issue and then I will read the tweets, what people think about that. Probably I will go to different parties. It's actually very interesting how algorithms work in that sense, because of course they know what you scroll, they know the following list. So if you follow, let's say, left-wing media, they will show you the comments that are most relevant to your views based on what you follow, what you like, what you post, what you share on your feed, and vice versa. I wanted to add something, but I forgot.
Maybe it was about, well, I'll talk a little bit more, because it just occurred to me when you were speaking then that even if, in say, take the example of, you follow a lot of left-wing publications, therefore when you see an article, the left-wing publications or the left-wing stance in the comment is shown to you, and that backs up your idea, and then you feel good and you're like, yeah, everyone thinks the same as me, this is great. Okay. But actually, if you think about it, if it showed the opposite, so if it showed all the right-wing talking points, I don't think it would change your mind. I think it would make you say, they're all wrong, they're talking crap, I'm right, and you end up in the same place, if you see what I mean. And this is the defining feature of social media, is it sends people to the extremes of whatever they believe. And it's a combination of bubbles feeding you back the same information over and over again, the same stance. But also, when it serves up content which is not your ideology, it tends to be stuff that makes you angry. So because all of these things keep you engaged with the network. So it's having this effect of pushing people basically apart and to the extremes of whatever it is they believe, is pushing them into their own corner and causing division amongst people. Is that something you notice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. I actually remembered what I wanted to say. There are several thoughts, so, you know. So first of all, I think that what you are mentioning is the effect of the collective psychology. Naturally, every single person needs a sense of belonging, needs to share their ideas, their views, and to be accepted in a community. And it doesn't matter whether you are liberal, whether you are radical, but still, you just will go for social validation. So of course, when you read the comments and you think, nice, I was right, and so many people share it. And it even boosts your ego in a certain sense, because then you think, yeah, cool, I was always thinking like that, and there is a social proof that my opinion is really valid. And then, on the contrary, you scroll and you see that people do not agree, and probably you won't go viral or expressive about that, but you will think, oh, these retards. And that's pretty much it. So yeah, there is a certain division on social media, but at the same time, it also forms the communities. It unites people by the views, because you might see the post from an acquaintance or the comment from an acquaintance and you think, okay, now we talk, I click with this person and this person shares my ideas, and this is how people bond. And even if sometimes we're talking about the cancel culture, we can also see that there is a division, but also the union of people at the same time, because if there is a very sensitive issue and lots of people find it very harsh, they will probably unite around this issue and they will share opinions and they will bond against someone, which I do not think that is a good idea, but this is the phenomena that we can see in the era of social media, and vice versa. What I wanted to say, and I forgot in the beginning, is that comment section can also be used by journalists in a way of conducting investigations, because sometimes it is complicated to find lots of information on, let's say, some social issue. But if you go to the comment section, you can get much more information, because let's say that you are covering the results of the election, and you are trying to understand the social phenomena behind that. For example, women, let's say, they voted for a more radical party than usually, and you're trying to understand the phenomena, why that happened. Of course, you can wait for exit polls, you can read the election campaign, and I'm not speaking about any specific party right now. I generalize just to give the audience the example. And then you go to the comment section, and probably women are speaking about that. And then you can understand so much more. And then you can also find particular people, you reach them out, you ask them about their opinions, you interview them, so that helps. And we can develop this idea. We also go to the comment section. Let's say something happened and you are investigating the real crime and you are covering that. And you can see from the comments, you can monitor the metadata. You can see that, there is the news that someone was shooting yesterday in the park. You go in Instagram and you see what was posted from the location yesterday. And if you see some moms walking around that park at that time and that date, metadata is very, you know, easy to check, with babies in the strollers, then okay, probably it was not that bad. And vice versa. So again, you can see that as a threat, you can see it as a tool for the division, you can see that as an issue, but also you can use it, you know, for profit in a sense.
One of the things I find really disheartening about comment sections is the way that some publications use them to create news. And it's the worst form of journalism. You know, I won't name any places, but, well, I could name one of some of the now defunct places that no longer run because the journalism got so bad. But they would basically run an article around a comment from Twitter or Facebook, you know, which is the cheapest and worst form of journalism I think I've ever come across, you know. And it, unfortunately, that's where we are. You know, online journalism is a place with not much financial backing behind it these days, especially in the larger media organizations. When I was a journalist, we were sent off on a job for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. You know, by the time I left, sometimes people were going out to the Middle East for a weekend to try and get the story. And what can you tell in that amount of time? You know, everyone knows now that the best source of news is coming from, well, for me, Twitter. That's where actual people, if you want to know about Gaza and what's actually happening, you can probably find people in Gaza tweeting or somewhere else similar. You can actually find real stories. And sure, it's hard to tell who's real and who's not, but you can train yourself to get trusted news sources on Twitter. It's quite simple. You know, it takes a bit of time to learn who are the trusted sources. But yes, of course, I would rather hear my news from somebody who's living the experience, who's not a professional journalist, than from a professional journalist who spends one weekend trying to dig up the story and really just getting a surface level opinion about it, pretty much. I've got a question, though, that something that just occurred to me. I was thinking it myself and I couldn't answer it, so I'm not sure you'll be able to answer. But can you remember the last time you had your opinion changed from a social media post?
Let me think, because
I tried it.
You caught me off guard, and that really requires more reflection, because again, as we are living in this info spin, I really need to reflect on all the info messages that I saw recently. Opinion.
It's very difficult to think.
I think that it was not on... I do not think it was on the big political matters, but for example, it's a very trivial one. I follow some businesses in Ukraine, and I also follow them on social media. And I see how, the way how they communicate, because it's just interesting for me as a social experiment, how they communicate, how they attract audience, whether they are just selling their services or they're building the community. Because I do think that these days, community is more important than just to go into direct aggressive sales. And there was one chain of coffee shops in Ukraine. I don't want to get specific with names, but... it started posting lots of content that did not resonate with my views. Then they were using, first of all, they continue working with Russia and selling some stuff there. And my opinion about them was changed based on that. But then they were also using very aggressive ideas in marketing, some of them are sexualized images or ads on Instagram. And imagine, firstly, you see that they did not leave the market. And that means that probably a part of taxes go for selling goods there. And you're like, interesting. And then you also see as a cherry on the top that they're using different things that are unacceptable to me in the communications and their social media. So in this way, my opinion was changed. With some deeper stuff, not that daily things, I do not think that my opinion was that much changed, because I think that for me, such big shifts, they require more time. And then I need to sit and to analyze more deeply and to reflect on that. So I do not think that my opinion would just change from one social media post. But I also think that our opinions might also get changed in daily stuff, in a sense how we view other people. And that's happening to us also all the time. We do not usually reflect on a way how we also build a certain image on social media. Some people do that consciously. That's why personal brands exist. But some of us, they do that unconsciously. We post that we listen to some music. Okay, people form their opinion because they usually build associations. We post something from this coffee shop. We post something that we go on the vacation here, or we don't go on the vacation there. We share some quotes, all in all. And these are micro things, but in the long run, that also forms the opinion. And with public figures, I think it's even more noticeable, because you post something and you will either get the positive perception, or you will just tweet one thing and it will get cancelled.
What, out of interest, what's your go-to social network for high quality factual news?
Social network?
If at all. It doesn't have to be. Like I say, for me, Twitter is where I go to form an opinion on, the best opinion I can on something that's happening. And it seems pretty good for that, especially if you've been using it for 15 years. You get used to knowing how to deal with the list of opinions and facts that you see.
Mm-hmm. I think for me it's the synthesis. And I think that I use different social media for different purposes. For instance, I stopped spending that much time on Instagram. And I also do not monitor the content that much there. But of course, I follow some online media there. And from time to time, I get their posts on the feed. If I want to get the opinions the same as you, I would go on Twitter. I'm not that much of a Facebook person. They generally do not have a habit of scrolling there. For LinkedIn, I do not follow it that much. I follow some newsletters, though, of people who I'm interested in, but again, it comes more in the form of email, so I'm not sure whether it's legit to mention LinkedIn in that sense. What I find interesting is that I spend some time on TikTok, and I know how many concerns, and for a very right reason, TikTok has with privacy, being used as a propaganda machine, then the recent claim from the US that they're going to ban TikTok, etc. But what I find interesting there is that there are lots of young people from, let's say, 15 to 35 who are on TikTok, and they are just average users. And usually these people do not reflect that much on the way how the videos that they post there will be perceived and where they will go, what's the databases that they will be stored. And that's why they share lots of information, basically. How people on TikTok would say they drop the lore. And with this lore, you can learn so much from the people. For example, some time ago, I was very interested in what's happening in Iran on a daily basis, especially with gender aspects, how women live there. So I searched on TikTok some profiles of young women who live in there. Some of them were students, some of them were working in public services, etc., etc. And I was just watching to their videos, and they, as natives, as locals, they were describing how their day was, what they wear, where they can go, where they're not allowed to go. And you won't find that much information just on the internet if you write Iran gender issues. You will find common things, you will find some precedents that might happen in a country, but it's not like you will find this daily information. And again, you find users that way, you can reach them out directly, you can talk to them. One opinion won't form your opinion, it's drastically wrong. But if you talk to several people, then you can get the puzzle collected. And the more you talk, the more you observe, it's even better if people have different opinions, because, again, as I said in the beginning of our conversation, truth lies somewhere in between, and you cannot speak about something just A or B, black and white, and etc. So this is my take on social media.
Interesting. I never used TikTok, and I don't intend to either. I can appreciate what you mean, though, that you do get a snapshot of real life. But I suppose my next question then is, as you alluded to, TikTok is the worst place to do that, right? So where should you do it? What do you, how much do you know about decentralized social media? Things like Nostr and things like this. Do you know much about that?
Well, I am on Nostr, but I am not the active user. I think it is good because it is something fresh that we can follow also in terms of privacy. And till this type of social media is more niche, it means that it is less regulated and it's just safer to use. I think that things might eventually get worse as much as more audience gets on this social media, because then it will be easier to regulate and there will be lots of content, and then people will realize that, aha, it's a thing and we can use that as propaganda tools as well. I think that all projects like that, they are good in the very beginning of their epoch. Eventually, it when it gets more viral, it brings more complications.
Do you ever find yourself using TikTok in the way TikTok intends? You enter TikTok looking for the kind of, say, take your Iran example, and before you know it, you're just watching video after video of something completely different, and it's not doing you any good at all. Does that happen to you?
I have limitations with this app, so I do not spend that much time there because I know that you can just get stuck there. But sometimes I might get there in the end of the hard work day. So the thing is that I'm working with information most of the day, for the whole day. And I need to analyze, I need to write, I need to talk to people. And in the end of the day, sometimes I just have no capacity to go out. I have no capacity to watch a movie. I have no capacity to read a book simply because I'm already so tired with working with information. So in that case, yeah, I know that I can doom scroll for half an hour before I go to sleep, but I'm trying not to overexceed it because I'm pretty much sure that it does not do you good. And it does not bring you really that much of value.
Do you find TikTok serves up a certain type of media to you at those moments? And is it something that is not good for you? Or what is it about that that's not good for you?
It is not a source of media to me. I think that it... But there is a phenomenon that lots of people, as I said before, they use it as Google. There is even a neologism to TikTok, the information. And in fact, that's true. If you want to find a recipe, you don't go on Google Recipes anymore. You go like how to cook pasta on TikTok. And in 5-10 seconds, you will get that. And that saves you time. And of course, that contributes to the horrible idea of the clip thinking. But no, it cannot replace the media. To me, not at all. I don't think it's about that much quality. No, I would like to verify my information, and I would not trust the social media platform that was launched by Chinese government in that sense. But as a sense of seeing some glimpses of someone's daily life, their routines, how life looks for people in different parts of the world, yes. Why TikTok can be harmful? Because first of all, based on privacy, I noticed that I might text something or I will say something now on the podcast, and then the chances are high that I will see that on my feed based on algorithms, and they're usually very accurate. So this is one of the concerns. The second thing is that you're just losing your time sometimes if you spend that much of it. And I do not think that using any social media platforms should collide with your social life or with the time that you can spend on your education in more classical form and self-development.
Just out of interest then, why don't you install a different operating system? Like, I use Graphene on my phone. It's a privacy operating system. And I never get fed up ads that are relevant to me because... none of the apps can listen to what I'm doing. I mean, sure, I'm relying on the developers of Graphene to but it seems a better option than having a phone where you actually see TikTok is spying on you, like you just said. Why would you carry on using it at that point?
Using TikTok?
Yeah. or that phone or that operating system that allows it. I mean, you literally, when you sign up for TikTok, as far as I know, in the terms of service, it pretty much says everything except we own your soul. It's pretty harsh. I seem to remember seeing someone talk about the TikTok terms of service on social media. So, mm-hmm. But I'm just interested that you would still use it.
I have two phones.
Okay.
So all crucial information I have on the other phone that has nothing to do with my doom scrolling, like work information, private information. And then there is also the phone for social media, for pictures and stuff like that.
Okay. Fair enough. Last question. Before we go, Ladies for Liberty, what's that? I see it all over the place. I've seen it at various conferences, and I've never actually interacted with anyone from Ladies of Liberty, but you work with them, right? What is it?
So this is the organization that unites women who stand for liberty, classical liberals, libertarians, who embrace the ideas of individualism. They think that it's a very good...
Ooh.
What was the sound?
I think it's a fire truck, isn't it? I should have closed the windows before we started.
I think it's a very good initiative for women to find a supportive community. Again, I do not think that it goes against, sharing the space or the ideas with men or exchanging, because quite often when people approach you that, they say, like, oh, cannot men be in Lola? No, I mean, you can be pro-Lola. But I also think that, as we can see on the representation of some webinars or in-person events, usually women represent less of the audience. And I think that it is harmful in the long run, both for men and women, because if you have misrepresentation of any voices, and it could be vice versa, if there was misrepresentation of the amount of men there, the same, then you feel like you do not hear the voices that could advocate for some ideas. And that's why Ladies of Liberty Alliance comes up. So they educate women about the ideas of libertarianism, classical liberalism, political things, advocacy, human rights, social issues. And I think it's great because you basically build the global ecosystem where you can learn from other women in quite informal way about what challenges they face. And again, if you see that from the multicultural perspective, international perspective, it means that you can fight for these ideas, advocate for these ideas, educate about certain issues and ideas more efficiently. So that's probably what I like about that. And we should also mention that, as far as I know, Lola was founded by someone from SFL alumni. And I come from SFL originally, so I learned about Lola just 2 years ago. I did not know that the organization existed before. But then I was at the retreat for women, Women for Liberty in DC, and that was co-organized by Ladies of Liberty Alliance. And I thought, okay, nice, I resonate.
What would you say then is the number one or the one of the biggest issues faced by women that's specific to women in the liberty movement or with ideas of liberty, which a man like myself probably wouldn't understand, wouldn't relate to?
That's a good question. Again, we're speaking about different places because the approach to the ideas of liberty would be very different, I guess, to women westwards and somewhere, let's say, from the Middle East. Of course, there are gender issues, first of all, and we are talking about that not just in the liberty movement, but from the perspective of human rights. There is a tendency that I notice with those who just joined the liberty movement is the way how you enter the movement, whether you feel comfortable to dig on the topics when you are just a newbie and you come to the conference, and let's say that 70 to 90% are men. And sometimes conferences really look like that. I was at some conferences where there were like 100 participants and 3 women. And let's say one woman works with different think tanks for many years, and like she knows people, people know her. But there is always this one student, freshman or a fresh woman, whatever, and she doesn't know how to approach people, and it's awkward. You are trying to get to the social group, and people are already talking, and they can go into details. And yeah, one can say that why your sex, why your gender should stop. You know, it should not. I do think that there is a dialogue. I do not think that we're talking about discrimination there, but it is just about the way to make it easier. So I think that it's a good thing to do.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that? This is my experience as well. Even here, we're in Prague now. Bitcoin, BTC Prague is a huge Bitcoin conference. And once again, it will be 95% men and 5% women. Me personally, you see, I don't think it's a problem. I think because I see quite an egalitarian network here, I don't see any barriers to entry. If you want to be into Bitcoin, if you want to find out about Bitcoin, you can be anyone. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. It doesn't matter what race you are. It's a great free open network. And I find the community as well very, very accepting and very, you know, I understand that it might be a bit foreboding as a woman to enter something that looks like a male dominated space. But why do you think it is that, you know, liberty, freedom, these kind of issues are something that men seem to play a part in much more publicly than women?
Do not you think that it might come from the way how actually kids are being brought up? Because I do think that at least in post-communist societies, it's quite often a thing. It's the same way as boys are into maths and physics, and girls are usually into more humanitarian subjects, which again is something that could be changed in the longer run. I also think that it is something that we can work with. I just lost my point because I got distracted. Can we start?
Yeah, sure, yeah. I'm talking about why it is that, let me just go back to the point made about that we teach our children that boys like maths and girls like social things. And I have three children, and girls and boys, and my experience, which is obviously anecdotal, but it does seem it's a common experience, is that men have a propensity for certain things and women have a propensity for certain things. And there's only so much you can do to convince them. Like I would have a hard time convincing my son, for example, to be into the same things that my daughters are into. And it's not a learned thing, because he's outnumbered. I have a son and two daughters, and the two daughters are older. So really, he should be doing everything the daughters are doing, but he's not. He's completely different. He is into maths and working out how things work and, you know, this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what I'm trying to find out, I suppose, is whether you think that some of these spaces, like the Liberty Movement, for example, or the Bitcoin movement, are going to be inherently places where men are more represented than women? Or do you think this is something that could be corrected or with some social things? I don't know, whatever.
Definitely corrected, because, of course, there can be some predeterminations of the interests. But again, it's the matter of how we educate women. And again, I think it goes broader. Now I got my point back. Thank you. I think that it goes beyond, because let's look even at the world of politics. Quite often these days there are quotas in the parliaments about how many men, how many women should be in parties, in parliaments. And what we can see from some countries that are more successful in different aspects, social and political, is that these are the societies that are gender balanced. Because then that means that different voices are being equally represented, and that helps to find a better balance between different issues, get several perspectives, and that also means the better presentations of different rights and ideas. So with the liberty movement, you know, sometimes I think that, again, it's a matter of communication, that, yeah, politics, economics, I don't know, technology is more for men or for boys. I was studying at the University of Humanities, and we had 14 girls in my group, and we had only one boy. But then, on the contrary, I remember that if I was going to some more physics, mathematics department, the situation was the opposite. 14 boys, and maybe, if the group is lucky, there's one girl. But there is something to change. I used to work with an organization which is called Women in Tech Ukraine. I was doing communication for them for a little while. And this is the organization, the ecosystem, actually, that inspires women to take the step in different technological fields, to build the startups, to find networking, to start their projects, to get funding or to find employees. And we were conducting studies, and it turned out that women were more likely to enter some community, like a psychological phenomenon. I do not say that, oh, what we should do with that, or whether it is good or whether it is bad. It is just the result of the study. So they were more likely to enter some community if they saw other women. Also, I think that quite often men and women, they also do tend to have different ways of delivering their ideas. And men are usually more, I don't want to use the word harsh.
I was going to say that.
Yeah, but kind of harsh. Yeah. Argumentative, maybe. Mm-hmm. I do not want to say aggressive because it has a negative connotation, but it's more firm, the way of how they deliver their ideas. While women, they usually use the different wordings. They are usually more mild in the communication. And also, it is something also that comes from my academic background. I was studying the way how different politicians build their public speeches. And turns out that women politicians quite often start their talking points from, it would be nice if, well, men usually start talking about the ideas, I think that, and then you think about the public perception, because the me concept usually sounds more persuasive than it would be nice if. But again, that could be one of the reasons. The lack of some role models, maybe, that could be. I think that most of the communities, they are welcoming, but of course there are some internal issues that maybe if someone is in some more closed community, more niche community for a little while, and you enter there and you do not have proper role models or someone that you can reach out and ask the question that you are interested, you might feel awkward. And actually, I think that can happen to men as well.
For sure.
But I lost my point again.
Well, I hear you talk about quotas, and I'm undecided about the idea of quotas. And it's a tricky one for me, because I don't like the idea of trying to manage anything like that. I would hope that, and going back to what you said about the harshness of the male environment, as all men will tell you, that's how we operate. You know, we are very cognizant of hierarchies, and, you know, this is something we're born to do, to try and fight our way to the top of the hierarchy. This is part of being a man, as far as I'm concerned.
Sorry to interrupt you. I think that hierarchy is just the way how we generally function as a society. So I think that happens to women as well, just on
true.
The level
yeah,
of
yeah.
human
of course,
beings.
Of course. It definitely happens in both. The problem with it is that men have a physical advantage, and therefore, in a hierarchy of men, the physicality of it is always an issue in the background. I'll give you an example. If two men have an altercation, so if two men are arguing, there is always the possibility of it becoming a physical fight. And normally that's the last resort. But that is something that we do. That's the that one of the aspects of the male experience is we're bigger and stronger and, you know, we do all these, that's, but that has a positive side, obviously, and a negative side. And that is one of the things that I find the most difficult to work out when you have a situation when men and women are competing in a place, because there isn't that aspect. When you deal with a woman as a man, it's completely different to when you deal with a man. And as you've said, what you like or what you would like to see is a slightly softer approach of men in that situation. And that's kind of what we do. But it doesn't work well if you're the kind of man who's really trying to struggle at all costs to win and to get to the top and to do the best, because we would just hope that we could compete with women the same way, but we can't, because it would be unfair, I think.
Well, you know, honestly, the idea of competition itself, I take it in a different way. I clearly want to succeed and I'm quite ambitious, but I do not see it in a way of real competition, because competition, it can be fair, it can be unfair. Sometimes it assumes that you need to bring someone down in order to climb the social hierarchy. But my core idea is the co-creation instead of competition, because I do clearly want to succeed, but I also want other people to succeed. And I also think that if you can co-create instead of some toxic kind of competition, you can achieve so much more. Because apparently this person who is also climbing the top of hierarchy or trying to succeed in a position or promote some ideas, it's a very smart person and it can bring a fresh perspective. Doesn't mean that you need to co-create with every single person. Of course, we naturally have our preferences. Some people we like, some people we don't like, some people we match, some people we don't match, and the other people do the same with us as well. But I think that you can just achieve so much more in a more organic and non-violent way.
Of course, I believe that too. What I wonder is, are we born with this in urge or not? For example, the trials and tribulations of being a man and are very different to the trials and tribulations of being a woman. And one of the things, men do, we derive our value from different things to women. So I derive my value from being useful, from being, you know, efficient, from being providing, for doing all these things. And as a result, it's quite important for me to be good at what I do and to basically present myself as high up the hierarchy as I can. And amongst men, there is an understanding that this is a battle to see who's the best, because you present yourself through the male hierarchy, let's say. And that's kind of how it is with men. When you enter the mixed space of women and men, that becomes really difficult. And I agree, working with people is a great idea as well. But you can't, the urge to compete is there. And it's not possible with a woman, because it's the foundation of the whole competition is completely different. I'm not sure I'm making my point very well, but I think what I'm saying is that that it's a very different, that there are very different impulses of men and women, and especially in men, of how we actually derive our value and how we make ourselves valuable in the world.
I think that the competition happens the same way with women. I mean, men compete with men, women compete with other women, in a sense. I do believe that women are the best advocates of other women. But sometimes women are the harshest ones who will also bring other women down if they have the conflict of interests. And I do not want to sound controversial, especially with engaging with our activism or not, but this is just life and this is what happens. The conflict of interests might happen. And this is just what we have. When we talk about the competition between men and women, I actually remember I was attending one conference a couple of years ago, and it was also prevailed by men, so there were like two women in a room with 200 participants, and that was kind of awkward. And there was a presenter, and she was talking about women leadership or something, and it was also something connected to liberty movement. I do not remember that well because it was a while ago, but I just remember that some lady from the audience, she gives her a very positive feedback after her speech publicly. And there is a guy who is sitting over there, and he says, yeah, but you know, would you really like us to see you women as a competition? Because probably you would not feel that you're attractive back then. And he put it in some sense of that. But we were talking specifically about the professional environment, not about any romantic connotation, which also brings a different context. And where I lead my point is that why cannot we just take other people as professionals in professional environment? Because then you will be just estimated by your skills. You have this amount of years of experience, you have these social skills, you have this kind of network, you contribute these efforts. And then whether you're a man or a woman, and the way how you achieve your objectives is a slightly different thing. In out of office hours, you can interact and engage whatever you want and how you prefer to.
I think that's a very important point, actually. But it does make me think. It helps me understand this process. So in a professional environment, yeah, there can be a lot of equality, actually, because there is a framework of professionalism. And that's good. Where I see the problem is that when you leave the professional environment, the enforcement of rights is something that normally happens through men. I mean, like, say you're walking down the street and someone tries to rob you. You call the police. It's normally a man. It's not always a man, but the actual, outside of the framework of professionalism, which is, here are the rules. Everyone's the same. You treat people with respect. You look at their merits. But out in the real world, or in a war, or in a whatever, when this framework disappears, then it's completely different and very hard to think in those same terms. And like I say, the main thing is that when you think about rights, and that's what the professional framework is, a framework of rights and responsibilities in a way, isn't it? Here's how you act, here's what you do, here's what you're expected of you. But out in the real world, those rights and responsibilities tend to be enforced by the men, you know, like because of history and because of the fact that we tend to be a bit stronger, and it often comes down to physical enforcement at the end of the day. So I agree with you, but I do think it's a really interesting time we go through. And I certainly myself find it hard to navigate. In a professional sense, easy. I love that. I agree. You know, but it's out in the real world that I find it difficult.
Well, in a personal context, I do not think that I have the immediate cure for this issue or challenge, whatever we call it. I think challenge is actually a better word, because then it is something that you can navigate. I think that the best recipe is actually to surround you with people who are open to have the dialogue about inconvenient topics, about equality if we want to, about the dynamics that we would like to see, about how just to make the world to function in a way that it is safe and convenient to both sexes, to all genders, if we want to sound more inclusive. In my real life, out of office hours, I'm very happy that I'm surrounded by respectful men, usually my friends or my colleagues, who I can lead conversations with, and who are always trying to ask if they are unsure about something. And me as a woman, it goes the same way. But of course, it does not mean that there are those people who are bubbled in their thoughts and who are not open-minded. And that brings a challenge. We can say that we could work and that we can educate and we can have the conversation, and that's very good and that's lovely. But I probably think that the easiest way to save your nerves is to stay away from these people.
That's easier said than done sometimes, though. But anyway, I think that's a good place to end. Tania, thank you. I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's been lovely talking to you. And you're welcome back anytime. And in fact, you're welcome back to our conference again, which I think possibly you may come, hopefully.
Likewise. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.